How to meditate on the breath. So that's all you need to know to get into jhanas. So I expect you've all got into jhanas by now. If not, why? What's the problem? So today, the talk is about what's the problem. About why it seems so easy. And it is, you put the all the steps in place and it seems, you know, very easy to understand, very clear. Exactly, you know what to do, but it doesn't happen that easy because we have problems in meditation. And of course, the first problem in meditation is actually not wanting to meditate. Obviously, that's why it doesn't work. So, whatever the mind finds important and valuable, that is what will take precedence in the mind. That is what the mind will go to all the time, what it thinks is really, really valuable. And our problem is, there's so many other things we have to do, so many duties. I'm sure there's many of you who are about to get into jhanas, but you thought, no, breakfast is more important. So you gave up your meditation to get some breakfast. Oh, you thought, you know, solving that problem is more important, so you started thinking. Oh, you thought, I'm not quite sure what else you get up to. But it's because other people, other things are more important. You want to get them out of the way. That's why you never meditate. And that is the meaning of what we call the monkey mind. I know that many people describe the monkey mind as a mind which runs here and runs there and all over the place, but that's not the real monkey mind. As one of my favorite stories will now reveal to you, once there was a monkey who had a monkey mind. And this monkey lived in Sri Lanka. And those of you who've been to Sri Lanka know that every week they have what's called Poya Day, when people go to the temple and they offer all this delicious food to the monks and the nuns, I hope, these days. And so much stuff comes that it's a great day for monkeys to go to temple too. But the monkeys don't go over there to keep precepts, they go there to break precepts and steal some food. It's a great day for the monkeys. So one day, the monkey went to the temple because it was the Poya Day, hoping to find a mango or a banana or something to eat, which happens very often because people drop things. And as he was waiting for somebody to drop something, he heard the monk give a lecture in the meditation hall. And the monkey was just sort of interested, especially when the monk mentioned the word monkey mind. Because, you know, everybody is really proud and sort of arrogant and conceited. When they start talking about you, you really get interested. So, you know, if I sort of started to mention about Niroda, her ears go up straight away. She wants to listen. So when Monkey heard Monkey Mind, his ears really perked up. I said, what are they saying about me? So he swung over to close to the window and he listened to this monk talking about the monkey mind. And the monkey was so upset because they weren't respecting the monkey mind. They weren't sort of realizing the beauty of a monkey mind. He was really downplaying the monkey mind, saying it's a bad mind, it's a crazy mind, it's the sort of mind you should get rid of. It's one of the worst types of minds a meditator can have, the monkey mind. And the monkey was just so angry. He can't say this about us. Now that's discrimination. You know, that's not respecting so our species. He can't, that's defamation. If I had a lawyer, I'd sue that guy. You can't say such things about monkeys. What's wrong with a monkey mind? A monkey mind's a good mind. Those guys don't understand anything. He was so upset. And so even though he hadn't eaten anything, he swung straight back into the middle of the jungle where the rest of the monkeys lived. And told all the other monkeys, you wouldn't believe what those Buddhist monks are saying about us. Now, I heard it myself. they were blaming the monkey mind, telling it was a terrible mind. That's defamation, that's slander. We shouldn't stand for that. And all the monkeys said, yeah, we can't stand for that. That's wrong. And they all started jumping up and down, complaining, getting more and more angry. And then the head monkey said, that's the monkey mind. Jumping up and down, complaining, and doing all that sort of stuff. And all the monkeys were wise enough to say, that's true. Because we never see the monks and the nuns doing that. They're quite peaceful and calm. So this must be the monkey mind. And we're monkeys. We're stuck with one. That's really terrible. But the head monkey said to them, said, look, I've been around a long time. And I've seen not just how the monks and the nuns, but how the lay people, how they overcome the monkey mind. They train the mind so it's not monkey mind anymore. It's a very peaceful, human, bright, wonderful mind. So how do they do that? And the head monkey said, they meditate. How do you meditate, said the monkeys. Well, I'm not sure, but I've seen them do it. So what you do, they said, you sit down, you put the right leg over the left leg, the right paw over the left paw, close your eyes, and you watch your breath. So the monkey said, yeah, let's do some meditation. Yeah, we'll do some meditation. We want to do some meditation. Calm down, said the head monkey. First of all, go and get a nice mat to sit on. So they went into the jungle, and they got some grass, and they got some leaves, and made themselves some nice little zafus, really big. And they said, right, said the head monkey, sit down. They all sat down. Right leg over the left leg, put the right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, chin in, eyes closed, and watch your breath. And that was the first time in the history of monkeyhood that monkeys ever meditated before. But you know what monkeys are like. Only for about 2 minutes. And then one monkey put his paw up. Excuse me, he said. And all the monkeys opened their eyes. So what is it? So, you know, I've been thinking. Because that's what you do when you meditate. I've been thinking that, you know, we had planned to raid the banana plantation for lunch. And we planned that this morning, do you remember? And I keep thinking about that. I can't get it out of my head. So look, why don't we get it out of the way, first of all? Once it's out of the way, then I won't need to think about it. And all the monkeys said, yeah, let's get that out of the way. So they said, but we won't eat the bananas yet. We'll just collect them, so I won't need to think about it. So my mind will be peaceful, and I can meditate. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So all the monkeys got up, and they swam to the banana plantation. They stole heaps and heaps of bananas. And they all brought them back. They didn't eat any. And they put them in this big mound of bananas in the middle of the clearing where they were meditating. And they got back onto their little seats. Right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, chin in, close their eyes and started meditating, watching their breath. Excuse me, said one of the monkeys, but I've been thinking about those bananas. He said, you know, what I've been thinking is this, you know, before we eat the bananas, you know, we have to peel them first. So let's get that out of the way. We won't eat them, we just peel them. Yeah, said the other monkeys, great idea. So they all got out from their meditation cushion and started peeling the bananas. They never ate any. They peeled them and put them in a nice heap. And then they went back to sit meditation. Right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, chin in, eyes closed, and meditating. So peacefully. Excuse me! Said one of the monkeys. I've been thinking, said the monkey. I've been thinking that, you know, before we eat those bananas, they're already peeled, but before we eat them, we have to put them in our mouth. So let's put them in our mouth first. We won't eat them, just put them in our mouth. So I can stop thinking about it and get it out of the way. Because when I get it out of the way, I don't need to think about it, and I can be peaceful. Yeah, great idea, said all the monkeys. So they all got a banana each and stuffed it in their mouth. They didn't eat it. Couple of monkeys put two bananas in their mouth. You know the ones, they're always here. You know them in the... Watch the lunchtime, you know those type of monkeys. Then they went back into their seats with bananas in their mouths. Right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw. Back straight, heads down, close her eyes. And as soon as everybody had closed her eyes, you all know what happened next. And they all ate all those bananas. And that was the end of their meditation. And that is what is called monkey mind. Let's get it out of the way first of all, and then we'll meditate. So you know what monkey mind is now. And that's what happens sometimes. Now today, okay, I'll get my washing out of the way, and then I'm and then I'll meditate. Oh, I'll get that letter written out of the way, then I'll meditate. Oh, I'll get the cleaning out of the way, then I'll meditate. Oh, I'll get the sweeping out of the way. Oh, I'll get this out of the way. And what happens? Your whole life gets out of the way before you meditate, which is that old saying, the only place in our modern world where you find anybody resting in peace is in the cemetery. When it's too late. So we meditate first. So meditate first. Get that out of the way, first of all. And then you can do all those other things. Just like that real Buddhist joke. It's very nice. You know that Buddhism is making its mark in the Western world when you have like real Buddhist jokes. I'm still waiting for like a Buddhist sitcom. They have like Big Brother at the monastery or something. You know, they have all these sitcoms like Life in the Monastery. But anyhow, and if anyone wants to do that, I know the scripts. I've got many scripts. All the stupid stuff which happens in Bodhidharma Monastery. But anyhow, back to where was I? I've forgotten now. Where was I? Oh, that's right, the Buddhist joke. A guy rings up the monk. And the monk picks up the phone. And they say, well, look, we need you to come to our house today to do some chanting. And my mother's very sick. We need you to do some chanting. And the monk said, I'm sorry. I can't come today. I'm busy. And the caller said, well, what are you doing? And the monk said, I'm doing nothing. That's what monks are supposed to do. You know, to rest, relax, you know, to meditate, but do nothing. Now, the layperson was wise enough to understand, very good, that's what monks are supposed to be doing. Do you want to have monks and nuns running around all over the place, just like executives? Or do you like monks who are nice and peaceful and calm and sit there doing nothing? Which sort of monks would you like? And so that man realized, oh yeah, carry on, very good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's the right thing to do. So, he hung up the phone. And he called the monk next day. And he got the same monk. And he said, I called yesterday, invited you to my house to do some chanting for me. You were busy yesterday. Can you come today? And he said, no, I'm busy today as well. And the caller said, what are you doing today? And the monk said, I'm doing nothing. But that's what you're doing yesterday. Yes, said the monk, I'm not finished yet. Well, that's a very good joke, but it's also very profound. So please get doing nothing out of the way, first of all. And then you can do all this other stuff. Because if you don't rest, you get sick. So that's one of the first things about meditation. Give it priority. It's important for you. And then actually you find the time for it. And number two, it's when you sit down. It's not just meditating, it's not just sitting down with your legs crossed in a perfect posture, because no one knows what's going on in your mind when you've got your eyes closed, except maybe some monks. Be careful what you think about. There's actually one of the monks I know. So some of you might know this monk, but I won't say who he is. He told me once that every morning they would meditate for 2 hours. Every morning, and it was just so hard for him. His meditation wasn't that good, and it was hot, and he was tired, and it was just, you know, and his legs would ache. And then one day, you know, one morning, you know, he decided, oh, no, I'm not going to watch my breath. I'm going to take a sexual fantasy. And that's what he did for 2 hours. He said, no aches and pains, no sloth and torpor. And then, you know, the time went by so quickly. And then when the bell went, you know, at the end of the meditation, then he got very afraid. Because, you know, his teacher was a great meditator. He thought, oh my God, I wonder if my teacher's read my mind. And sure enough, the teacher walked right over to him and looked him in the eye and said, you've just been wasting your time, and then walked away. I thought, wow, that's actually a great teacher. He's not saying, you stupid monk, what type of monk are you? You know, doing all that stupid stuff. No, he said, just be wasting your time, which was very powerful teaching. So if you do go thinking about all sorts of stuff, whether it's fantasies, whether it's plans, whether it's memories, or writing your memoirs, whatever it is you're doing, you're just wasting time. It's a beautiful thing. Don't feel guilty about it, but just think, what am I doing this for? Meditation is really important. And even actually getting on one of these retreats is very lucky, because there's about 20 or 30 people on waiting list, isn't there, Dania? 30 people. So you're lucky to get here. So don't waste the time and just, you know, thinking about things which aren't really important. So when you give the meditation importance, then one of the greatest hindrances is gone. Now, it's not just meditation, like I said, sitting down. It's what's going on in your mind as well. So you give peace importance. I mentioned this on one of the earlier talks about how to be quiet, how to be silent. Because sometimes I look to my mind and say, why does it think? Because a lot of times the thinking is about useless stuff. And you know that if you think about that, it's not going to get you anywhere. It's not going to solve any big problems. You know, it's just basically wasting time. So why do you do it? So I looked and saw that the main reason why people think is because they're not happy. They're not content. Now, I've sometimes seen these elderly people, been married for years, and they actually love each other, they've got this excellent relationship, they don't need to speak to each other. They're not just not talking because, you know, they've made a vow, I'm never going to talk to you again. I know that happened to one couple, a Thai girl married to an Italian man, and they were working in the same restaurant, it was the man's restaurant. And they had this vow for about 18 months, they wouldn't talk to each other, not one word to each other. And so when we went into the restaurant for a meal, you know, he came up and said, oh, what do you want? And had a nice chat with us. And then afterwards she came up and she said, what did he say? About 18 months they never said a word to each other. They refused. And they lived in the same house, worked in the same restaurant. It was so funny. But anyhow, some couples, they don't speak to each other, not because they've had an argument, because they don't need to. They're so content in each other's presence. They know exactly, you know, what the other person wants and what they need. And so they just go with each other just so peacefully and so kindly and so contentedly. And I often notice that when you are really content, there's nothing much to talk about. There's nothing much to think about. When you're content, the mind becomes very peaceful. So, how do we overcome that thinking mind? We become content. And the story behind that, so you know what contentment really means. And it shows you don't have to have perfect conditions to be content. It's the old story of the monk who went to teach in the prison. After I became the abbot and became too busy, I gave teaching to another monk, and he went to this new prison. He was teaching there for quite a few weeks. And one day they asked him, can you please stay behind? We got some tea and some cheese and chocolate for you. We found out what you like. And he just want to talk with you, find out, you know, who you are and what you do. So he stayed behind a bit longer, and they gave him a nice cup of tea, and they started talking to him. And one thing they asked, one thing which many people ask, is, you know, what do you do in your monastery? What's the daily life of a monk? So he went through the schedule. He said, in monastery we get up at 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock, they said. Even in prison you don't have to get up that early. And then he said, it is optional. You can always get up earlier, but not later. So what do you do after 4 o'clock? You know, the prisoners, because they didn't have any idea of what a monastery was, a Buddhist monastery. You know, can you watch the late night movie? No, we don't have TVs in monastery. We meditate. And they said, oh, okay, fair enough, you're monks. That makes sense. But then you have your breakfast. Yeah, it was a very simple breakfast at those times. We have one of these cups, you can put some cereal in, and that was it. Said, oh, in prisons in Australia, you can get bacon, you can get eggs, you can get pancake, you can get fruit. Yeah, you name it, you can get it. You're not in monastery, just we have the seals and that's it. And then what happens after breakfast? You know, so can you just sit around and sort of chat to each other? They said, no, we work. We work quite hard over in monastery. You see that even here in that teacher's cottage, which I'm staying in now, the roof isn't finished yet. You know, you can see pictures of me on that roof, building it. You know, people actually didn't believe that I built. We had a conference here in June of monks and nuns. And when they came along, they said, yeah, we always heard you said you were building. We didn't believe you. We thought it was another one of your jokes. So they actually saw me on the roof. So, yeah, you know, we do work as well. And the prisoners, they said, wow, you'll never get us to work hard like that. We go on strike. You know, even prisoners can go on strike in Australia. But anyhow, so we sometimes work very hard, even me. And what do you have for lunch? And you know, you've seen our bowls. Actually here it's a bit nicer than at our monastery because the sweets come in a separate bowl afterwards. But in monastery that doesn't happen. Everything goes in the same bowl. Everything. I remember going to Chithurst Monastery in England once. And this guy, he worked for the custard company. So he had all this custard for free. So every day we had custard. And unfortunately, when they put it in your bowl, it didn't go in the right place, but went on your spaghetti. I never forget this monk. He had his bowl there, and his Ajahn Sucitto was putting the custard in. And he's looking at him, please, please. So many times we had custard on spaghetti. I've had ice cream on curry. You should try it one day. Chocolate ice cream on your curry. Maybe today. Is any ice cream today down here? Okay. If there is some, put it on your curry and find out. It is actually very disgusting, but you should try it out. That's actually how we eat it. That's really awful. That's terrible. He said, they're told in solitary confinement, they give you a tray. And there are different things, the vegetables, you know, the meat or the curries or whatever, and then the fruits and the sweet, whatever it is. It's all in different compartments. It's disgusting how you live. But then what do you do after lunch? You know, can you play sport? You know, can you have a game of soccer? And you know, these are stories, you know, you've heard many times before, but it's your fault because this is supposed to be a new person's retreat. So if you've been here before, I'm not going to feel guilty. But he said, once I thought of starting a Buddhist soccer team. You know, that's actually how... Now, many of the... Because I used to follow soccer in England. Many of those football teams, they started off as church charity teams. You know, Arsenal and so Chelsea. They were all started by local churches and having a group of their young people play soccer to get them off the streets, you know, to teach them some discipline. And that's where they all started. So at many places, we could have like a Buddhist soccer team, and just for the sake of interreligious harmony, you know, we could play the Muslims and play the Christians. But, as soon as I started thinking deeply about it, if it was a Buddhist soccer team, we'd have to really use Buddhist principles, such as letting go. If the other team wants the ball, let them have it! Not attachment. If they can't score a goal themselves, kindness. Own goal. That'd be a Buddhist soccer team. That's why the teams in Sri Lanka and Thailand and Burma are no good. They'll never win. Because they're Buddhists. Come on, kindness. You win. We don't mind. So I say, no, we don't have any sports. We meditate again. Oh, gee. "Don't you get tired of meditating?" And the monk said, "Well, I've got to be honest, yes, sometimes." "But then what do you do in the evening for dinner?" "Dinner?" he said. "Monks don't have dinner. You know, actually, even the cheese. I only allow cheese over here. We don't allow cheese over in Bodhidharma Monastery. Only you have to come over here. That's why many monks come to listen to me talk to me." No, that's not true. But anyhow. So he said, "Oh, we get a full meal. You know, it's lots of choices in prison. So what do you do after, you know, your tea and chocolate or whatever? Then what do? You know, can you play cards, a bit of Monopoly, or play guitar or whatever?" "No, we don't do anything like that. We just meditate." "Oh, God." He said to prison, "So what time do you go to bed?" "About 10 o'clock. I know that, sorry, that's not what he said. He said, "What time do you go to bed?" And he said, "We don't have beds. Over here I've got a bed. It's really comfortable. I'm sleeping too much. That's the reason why. But over there where I live, you'd maybe go and see it in my cave and sleep on the floor." "On the floor," they said. "You know, even murderers, they get a mattress." And actually, that's pretty accurate as to how we live. And the prisoners were really taken aback. And, you know, over the weeks, they got to like this monk. And they felt so sorry for him that one of the prisoners forgot where they were. And they blurted out, and this is true, they said, "It's terrible where you live in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead?" He got an invite to come into jail, stay with his friends. And they said that because for them, and actually it was accurate, it's much more comfortable being in a prison in Australia than it is being in Bodhinyana Monastery. The conditions are far more luxurious. So, why is it that there is a huge waiting list of people trying to come into Bodhinyana Monastery? Even a couple of days ago, I had to tell the secretary, Janarato, to write, 2 people can't come. We're full up. Why is there a waiting list? What's the difference between a monastery and a prison? The only difference is, in a monastery, people want to be there. In a prison, doesn't matter how comfortable it is, you don't want to be there. That's the only difference. And from that, I realized what a prison really is, and what freedom is. A prison is any place you don't want to be. Any place you don't want to be. If you're fed up with this stupid meditation center, this meditation center has now become a prison for you. If you don't like your relationship, the people you live with, then that becomes another prison for you. You don't want to be there. If you're in a job you hate, your office becomes a prison. And if you are meditating and you just don't want to be here, your mind is now a prison for you. Any place you don't want to be is prisons. And that's suffering. It's got nothing to do with the comfort. This happened to me once. I was going to this Buddhist summit in Japan. And these people, they must be very wealthy because they put us up in a really luxurious 5-star hotel. So I was put in this hotel with a TV I couldn't switch on, with a spa I couldn't use, with a mini bar which you couldn't even touch. And the worst thing about it, I was stuck in here. And I was a forest monk, I like walking, going outside, I was stuck in this room. And after about half an hour, I started feeling this was a prison for me. Because I didn't want to be there, I wanted to get out and, you know, go into some nice nature, to see some trees or some grass rather than the inside of a hotel room. And I realized, it was an amazing thing, that moment, I was in a 5-star hotel. And to me it was a prison. I realized that any place, it can be luxury, but when you don't want to be there, that is a prison. And it doesn't matter how harsh it is, if you want to be there, you're content, then you feel free. And to me, that really made it quite easy to meditate. It meant, doesn't matter what I'm experiencing, I've got a sore knee, I'm tired, I'm restless, my meditation's not getting anywhere, but I'm content. I'm happy with my stupid mind. I'm happy with my tiredness. I'm happiness with my aches and pains. What do you expect? How old are you now, Bhikkhuni Satima?
76.
Have you got lots of aches and pains?
Yes.
Of course. That's par for the course. So you can't get rid of them. What do you expect? So you've got to be content and happy to be here. And then you're free. It's not a problem anymore. So it doesn't matter how you feel. She looks pretty content. She hasn't complained or moaned once. I have, getting up in the morning. Oh. That's actually why in the northeast of Thailand, you know what they did have a name for the elderly? Like a mister is called poor and missus is called mayor. So in the northeast, they call the old men poor oi and the old women mayor oi. And the reason is because when they get up, they go oi, 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 oi. That's true, that's a Thai joke, but it's true. So you can call your granny Mrs. Oi. Because you'll go, oi. But anyway, you can be content. And when you're content, when you want to be somewhere else, then you're in prison. So the way to overcome this thinking is be content to be here. No matter where it happens to be. You don't have to be in a luxury suite. You don't have to be in jhana. You don't have to have a body which is in perfect health to be content. You just need to want to be here. This is good enough. This is okay for me. Contentment. No desire. No wanting. And you can be content anywhere. That's an amazing insight. You don't have to have a perfect body, a perfect world, a perfect room, a perfect cough. You don't have to have perfect anything to be free. You just need to want to be here. So one of the biggest hindrances you have in your meditation is not wanting to be here. Wherever that happens to be. Even sometimes people have these beautiful limiters and they're not content. I want to be in jhana. They're in first jhana, they're not content. Oh, I want second. Give me more, 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 more. That means there's no contentment, no happiness there. So the trick in meditation to overcome the hindrances is no matter what's happening right now, be totally content. No matter what you're experiencing, happy to be here. And if you're happy to be here, that's present moment awareness. The happiness is the joy. Because you're happy to be here, there's nothing much to think about. Because all the thinking is trying to solve a problem. If there's no problem, there's nothing to think about. You know what is a problem anyway? This was actually a story which I wrote in Opening the Door of Your Heart. I haven't told it for years. It's great because what is a problem? There was a war going on between Israel, Jordan, Syria, Egypt. It was called the Six-Day War. I think it was 1967, I think it was. Six-Day War. And during the middle of that war, there was an interview by the BBC of the, I think he was just the former British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan. And in the interview they asked him, he said, what do you think about the war in the Middle East? Oh no, he said, what do you think about the problem in the Middle East? And he said, there is no problem in the Middle East. Amazing thing to say. And the journalist said, there's a war on. The people are dying. The tanks are blowing each other up. People are being killed, men, women and children. What do you mean there's no problem in the Middle East? And this very wise statesman, former Prime Minister, said, sir, a problem is something with a solution. There's no solution in the Middle East, therefore it can't be a problem. It's like a Zen saying. It's actually brilliant. A problem is something with a solution. If there's no solution, it's not a problem. So stop thinking about things with no solutions, which is what you spend most of the time thinking about. It's not a problem. You know, all your aches and pains, Bhikkhuni Satima, is that a problem? Can't be, there's no solution. So you can't not waste the time thinking about it. You know, all your stupid meditations, you know, your sleepiness, your restlessness, is that a problem? No solution. So it's not a problem. Be content with it, and then you're free. So when you understand the deep meaning of that saying, there's not much point to think about all this stuff. And you're just totally content. This is good enough for me. There's no business to be done. So you can relax. And in that contentment, the mind doesn't move. That's why it's called contentment. It's a state of mind which is happy no matter what it's experiencing. The trouble with most people is that they want to have a nice object before they can be content. They want to get everything just right, get all the problems out of the way before they're content. And you find you'll never find contentment that way. They want to find the perfect partner, the perfect job, the perfect monastery before they can be content. And that's endless. So there comes a time when you say, this is good enough, and you're content right now. That's another mantra which you can use. They asked last night about mantras which really help healing. One of the best mantras which heals the mind. You can use this with your breath, or you can use this when you're doing walking meditation. As you move your left foot, say, good. Right foot, enough. Good, enough. As you breathe in, good. Breathe out, enough. Good, enough. For the Thai people here, there's two Thais here. It comes from the old Thai mantra, Pordi. Pordi. Good enough. Because when you say that to yourself, it stops all this discontent and all this movement of the mind, all this trying to achieve to get things better, and instead you relax. It is good enough. This retreat center is good enough. The food is good enough. The teacher. Okay, it's good enough. And you meditators, are good enough. So when you say, I am good enough, Pordi, good enough, then you're content and happy. And all this terrible trying to be better, striving to be something different than you are, all this stuff which creates all the thoughts and the agitation, all disappears. You're sleepy, this is good enough. At least if I'm dull and sleepy, at least I can't be breaking any precepts. So this is good enough. So that means that you learn how to have a wonderful sense of contentment. Now, again, it's easy when I come along and say all this stuff and people think, oh yeah, I can meditate now, oh, I know what the problems are. And then next meditation, off you go, the same old habits, the same old mistakes, again and again and again. And there's that old simile of the five horses. The Buddha said that there were once five horses. The first horse, just when the owner, when the rider tells it to do something, it does it straight away. It's very obedient and faithful. Just like, you know, the first type of disciple. You know, you give them some instructions and straight away they follow it and they get into jhana and become enlightened very quickly, very easily. They're really good disciples. That's like the first horse. The second horse, the rider has to take out the whip. But just when the shadow of the whip falls on the horse, they know what they need to do. They only suffer a little bit and then they behave. The third horse, the owner has to tap it. And then it follows the instructions. A tiny bit of suffering, But only a tap doesn't really hurt, but just reminds it, oh, you better behave, or else. And the fourth type of force, the teacher has to whack it. Ow! Only once, though, and then you learn your lesson. You've been meditating and suffered once, and that's enough. You learn your lesson, never do that same mistake again. And the fifth force, whack, 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 whack. And it still it doesn't learn. They meditate and they get into sloth and torpor, restlessness, suffering, 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 so many times, so many retreats, and they still don't understand. So the question now is, which horse are you? Hands up if you're the fifth horse. Go on. Everybody usually puts their hands up. They all identify with the fifth horse more than any other ones. Suffer, 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 suffer. Why do you keep on suffering when you meditate? Why can't you have some bliss and peace and contentment, for goodness sake? So, when you understand the sin with the five horses, come and be smart. Use wisdom, power. Don't keep on suffering. You remember that first talk which I gave about the two types of meditation? What are the two types of meditation? Yes, second noble truth meditation, third noble truth meditation. Second noble truth, desire leads to suffering. Third noble truth, letting go leads to bliss. So, what meditation have you been doing so far? Have you been suffering, 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 suffering? If you have, don't think, oh, what am I doing wrong? You know what you're doing wrong. It's desire. That's what's caused a problem. I don't think I should desire more to get rid of these things. Don't have more willpower, less willpower, please. And then you do third noble truth meditation. Letting go, contentment. Stopping controlling things. Then you become peaceful. You become happy. You may even become enlightened, who knows? Because you've let go. So that's what we always remember. So we always use wisdom power to understand the problems which happen in our meditation. And in order to help with that wisdom power, so you always keep remembering, there's something which I call programming mindfulness. To program mindfulness, okay, so you may have this recurring problem in your meditation. Say that, you know, as soon as you start getting peaceful, you know, you tend to control things. So let's say you get afraid. You're about to let go, the body's about to disappear. And, what's happening to my body? That's one problem which comes up for people. So what you do is you program your mindfulness. You tell yourself when you start meditating, when my body starts to disappear, it's fine, it's all right. When my body disappears, I won't react. When my body disappears, I won't react. Something simple you say to yourself three times. Then you forget it. And then you just go and meditate. And it's amazing how well that works. You start to get to that usual place where you have a problem, and the mind does it automatically. You're about to lose your body, get afraid as usual, but something inside of you says, don't react. You see the program working. It's like an antivirus on your computer. As soon as it sees some bad software coming in, then it catches it and stops it. Automatically. It's called programming your mindfulness. If, for example, you know, you always get lost in sloth and torpor, and you know you slept enough, so it's not sort of physical, it's like dullness or boredom, you would actually notice on that path to meditation, to calmness, it's like you come across a fork in a road. And you do have the choice to go left or go right in that fork in the road. If you go right, it goes to sloth and torpor. If you go left, it leads to peace, but with awareness. And you know there's a fork there, so you tell yourself when you begin meditation, when I get to that fork in the road, I will take the left path, which leads to peace and awareness. I will take the path which leads to peace and awareness. I will take the path which leads to peace and awareness. You're programming the mind. And then it goes in that direction. Programming the mind is really important, and when you actually get to the very deep stages of meditation. For example, when you get to those nimittas, which I was talking about earlier. Because if a nimitta comes in your mind, and there's a problem there, and you've tried to solve the problem, then you disturb the whole thing. It's just like Ajahn Chah, still forest pool, you know, sitting there quietly, and this beautiful animal comes out, and Ajahn Chah moves, and the animal sort of senses there's someone there, and Ajahn Chah says, stop, be quiet, be still. And of course, just doing that much, you know, his movement. So the animal knows even more so that someone watching and goes away and hides. Any movement of the mind, the nimitta comes up, it's going to disturb the whole thing. So the way to actually solve problems when it gets to nimitta is put the instructions in at the very beginning, programming mindfulness. You say, when the nimitta comes up, I'll be like Ajahn Chah, I'll be totally silent and still. When the nimitta comes up, I'll be like Ajahn Chah. When the nimitta comes up, I'll be like Ajahn Chah. You say that to yourself at the beginning, you forget it. And it's incredible how well that works. When you get to those stages of nimitta, the instructions kick in. You don't move because the instructions have already been programmed. And you remember, the mind knows to sit like an Ajahn Chah and just watch. Programming mindfulness works really, really well. It's also the essence behind my snake simile. Snake simile, I think I mentioned this earlier on, but here it comes again, quite a few days ago now, but it's how we overcome these problems. There is usually one hindrance which gets you every time, one problem which keeps coming up in your meditation time and time and time again. So how do you deal with that? You can use the simile of the snake. Staying in Thailand, in the northeast, with Ajahn Chah, a really poor monastery, I had no batteries for my flashlight, no shoes to wear because the thongs all broke. And there was no new ones, it was a very poor monastery in those days. And so I had to walk without any shoes on through the jungles where all these venomous snakes slithered at night time through the jungle with no flashlight. Even some of you are a bit concerned about just walking in dark paths in Jhana Grove. There are no snakes here. You're perfectly safe, but sometimes you're a bit scared. But imagine in Thailand, first thing which I was told when I got to that place is 100 species of snake, I was told, in that jungle. 99 of that 100 are venomous. If they bite you, you either get very sick or you die. And the last one, the 100th one, is the one which strangles you to death. So they're all really, really dangerous. And there you were, walking without any shoes on, in the darkness, in the territory of the snakes. That was scary. But because I knew the snakes were around, because I knew I had to walk and they were very dangerous, I was constantly on the lookout for them. There wasn't one moment when I walked back where I started daydreaming or sort of thinking about what I was going to do tomorrow. I was totally aware, on the lookout for those snakes. And if I saw a shadow across the path, I would jump over it. I'd go another way. I wasn't sure. It could be a snake. It could be just a shadow or a stick. Who knows? But I'd take no chances. And I never got bitten simply because I'd set up my mindfulness at the beginning of the journey to be on the lookout for those snakes. And that's like in meditation. You set up your mindfulness to be on the lookout for your major defilement, the one which keeps catching you and biting you and strangling you again and again and again. That's the one you really set your mind up for. Only one at a time. So if it's really like sleepiness or boredom, say it's boredom, you tell your mind, at the beginning of the meditation, I'll really be on the lookout for boredom. And I'll avoid it. I'll look out for boredom, I'll avoid it. I'll look out for boredom, I'll avoid it. You set yourself up at the very beginning, then you forget it, you carry on meditating, you'll be surprised when boredom starts to come, you see it so early you can take another path. It never catches you again. But only do one problem at a time. Don't start the meditation and say, I must look out for boredom, restlessness, thinking too much, being afraid. Because that confuses your mind like hell, just one at a time. But it is true that sometimes that you do get many hindrances in the meditation. Sometimes people have meditations, they think they're going crazy. I know somebody came up to me once and said, yeah, there's these five hindrances they say in Buddhism, which is desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt. I get all of them at the same time, they said. All come together. And I never figured out how you can be dull and restless at the same time. How you can watch something and have ill will and have doubt. It's obviously craziness, but sometimes that's what it's like. Your mind is all over the place. And if ever that happens to you, that there's craziness and your mind is totally out of control, you're going mad, you're going out of your brain, you know, just with all this stuff going on inside of you and you can't take it any longer, what should you do? And that is where you use that wonderful method of overcoming the attack of all the hindrances, which I've called the Nalagiri method. Coming from the story in the time of the Buddha, when somebody tried to assassinate the Buddha. And they did this by getting this big elephant, getting the elephant drunk, and then setting the elephant in the path of the Buddha when he was coming on arms. It was these very narrow streets in the city of Rajagaha. And there was the Buddha, walking mindfully on arms round. And there was the elephant coming the opposite direction, smashing everything, stomping on things, breaking down trees. It's just a path of destruction. And all the people were running away, and they saw the Buddha coming slowly on arms round. See, when you tell a story, you have to give it some life to it, to make it so that people get excited. And they say, get out of the way, get out of the way, a bad elephant is coming, quick, get out of the way. Monks are very peaceful and calm beings. But most of the monks, they jumped over the walls, climbed the trees, they ran away too. All except for two. The Buddha. He's not afraid. He's not a namby-pamby cream puff like those other monks. And his faithful disciple, Ananda. For those of you who know the story of the Buddha, Ananda loved the Buddha and would do anything for his teacher. So much so that Ananda stepped in front of the Buddha. Let the elephant take my life. I will sacrifice myself for my beloved teacher. Wasn't that sweet? Some of you call me your teacher. How many of you would do that for me? You wouldn't even stand in front of me if a kangaroo was charging. Anyway, Ananda's the elephant. The elephant take me. The Buddha. Very nice, Ananda, but get out of the way. I can handle this. So poor Ananda lost his moment of glory. And there it was, just the two of them. The crazy, powerful elephant against the soft, wise, compassionate Buddha. Who would win? I'm sure that if there were bookkeepers at that time, they'd be taking odds. 2-1 for the Buddha, 5-1 for the elephant. But as they charged together like high noon in Rajagaha, these two amazing powerful forces coming closer and closer together, what did the Buddha do? Now there are such things as psychic powers. And the Buddha had them, heaps of them. And I am convinced if the Buddha wanted to, just like some martial artist, he could have grabbed the elephant's trunk quickly before the elephant could do anything. Swung it 3 times around his head. Just like in the movies, like Superman. This is Super Monk, this is the original superhero, the Buddha. And thrown it over the Ganges River, you know, 300 miles away. But just so it landed very softly, because the Buddha was very compassionate. He could have done that easily, no trouble at all. But that would have been violent. The Buddha's not into violence. So what did the Buddha do? He didn't fight force with force. He fought this incredibly powerful elephant with compassion. Dear Nalagiri, the door of my heart is fully open to you, no matter what you ever do to me. You can trample me under your powerful feet, and make me hamburger patty. You can pick me up and smash me against the tree. But whatever you do to me, Valagiri, I always forgive you, and I'll always love you and care for you. Because the door of my heart's open to you, Valagiri, whatever you ever do. And with that type of loving kindness, not a loving kindness which wants anything, which protects yourself, which says to the person bearing down upon you, whatever you do to me, you're already pre-forgiven. I care for you, the door of my heart's open, no matter what you ever do. That is irresistible. Before the elephant hit the Buddha, he'd stopped, had his head bowed down before the Buddha, and the Buddha was stroking his trunk. There, Nalagiri. There, Nalagiri. That's how the Buddha subdued the great elephant, who was crazy with alcohol, with a beautiful loving kindness. And that's how you subdue all your hindrances when they all come at once, when you're going crazy. Don't fight it, you know, with force. Fight it with, don't even fight it, except with kindness. Dear mind, it's all right being crazy. You can send me to the funny farm for the rest of my life. It doesn't matter. I still forgive you, mind. And after a few minutes, 3 seconds, your mind will be like that elephant just bowing before you. And you just stroke it. There, mind. It's all right. I love you, mind. I know you're crazy sometimes, but you're still my nice friend. You know that works. Kindness overcomes most of the hindrances when it's done unconditionally. The unconditional part is the most. Don't be afraid whatever happens. Say whatever happens, I'll still give you love and kindness and acceptance and respect. And then the mind gets just so soft. And all the hindrances vanish. Restlessness, sloth and torpor, ill will, craziness, a whole lot. Just kind. Ah, it's alright. You get nice and peaceful and soft and relaxed and at ease. So that's one of the marvellous ways. I use that a lot. You know, sometimes I get into parts of meditation that get stuck. You're not getting any deeper. Sometimes, what's going on? Why is it not working? And then I say, okay, I'm going to be kind. Doesn't matter. I don't want to get any. I'm just so happy I'm this far. Mind, I just love you so much. You don't have to get deeper. Not for me. Just be yourself. I don't care. I'm just happy to be here with you. And then the mind goes very deep, very quick. When I want something, it's called hatred. You're hating this moment, you want to be somewhere else. You're not content, you're not free. So when you love this moment, no matter what it is, I'm tired, I'm achy, I'm thirsty, I want to go to the toilet, I want to go to have a shower, I want to go for a walk, it's okay. I love you as you are. And then when you do that, the mind gets so peaceful and very still. So please, again, always try a little bit of loving kindness from time to time in your meditation. And you'll find that many of the hindrances are overcome very quickly. You do feel peace. But you've got to do it properly, 100%, not 99%. And then many of those problems in meditation, they just vanish. You have a wonderful time. You enjoy yourself. So it's not telling you what to do. All those problems in meditation, which have been there for years and centuries, which Buddhist monks we know about, and that we tell each other, you know, from teacher to disciple, how to overcome those problems. So it's all been worked out a long time. Don't ever think you've got a problem which has never been seen in 2,500 years of Buddhism. You know, you're well, we know that. It's been there, done that. So you're quite confident to know these methods actually work. But just remember to do them. Remember about those monkeys. Remember, don't get all those other businesses and chores out of the way and then you meditate. Please meditate first. And then you can do all those other chores. And then you'll have a wonderful time. So that's the talk for this evening. How to overcome some of the obstacles in meditation. So here we go. Come on. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Every time you laugh, you don't get bored of that, do you? Maybe by Sunday you get bored, but anyway, from now on it's pretty good. Okay, so have a nice morning.